Hey guys, what the heck is up? Okay, so first and foremost, you are absolutely going to hear Clover just being a menace in the background. One second. She's a puppy. She's a puppy. She can't help it. She's feral, or at least she thinks she is and wants to be. So ignore her. We'll just keep on going, okay?
You're not gonna be naughty this entire episode.
She really loves flies. And my apartment seems to be like the home base, the HQ of Flyland. And she just has a heyday. They get trapped between the baby gate that I have in my sliding glass door. And it's basically just a free-for-all for Clover. So ignore her as best as you can. And if you can't, I'm sorry. But she is the new addition to the podcast. She's our mascot. She's crazy. And we love her. Also, I don't know how the audio is going to be because right now my computer is broken. So I'm back to doing things on my phone and I'm not sure how the audio is going to pick up on the microphone that my old microphone. So bear with me. We're just Hot Mess Express. Okay. Y'all are used to this though. Y'all, this is nothing new. I'm currently sitting on the floor, and my phone and microphone are propped up on one of my plant stands. And so yesterday, I found a baby lizard in my apartment. For where I am located, this isn't anything rare. But I'm scared that there's going to be another one, and he's going to crawl on me. It was a baby brown anole, A-N-O-L-E. I don't know. I'm not a biologist. Okay, goodness, let's get started. So I have a few updates on a previously covered case for y'all. The Angela Goddard case, y'all remember that? This was the case where the woman was murdered by her boyfriend right outside of Hayes, Kansas. So I heard through someone close to a cousin of the guy that he allegedly committed suicide at Cape Canaveral in Florida. I'm sorry, I don't know the pronunciation of that. On the 11th of May. So I can't find it printed or like posted anywhere, but he was released from prison in December of 2021. So someone close to the family says that he committed suicide. So that's the update on that case. Y'all know the drill. Grab a snack, grab a drink, and grab your projects. Let's get into this. Today I'm crocheting a granny square dress kind of thing. If you go over on my Instagram, you can see two tops that I made that are similar to the dress that I'm doing right now. My Instagram is Crochet and Crime Podcast, for those of y'all that are new here. Did I even do my intro correctly? What the heck is up? I'm Elle. Welcome. If you're new here, I am so sorry that this is the first episode that you're hearing. And if you're a returning friend, then, you know the dizzle. Okay, so today we're going to talk about three different cases. This was supposed to be an episode with my boyfriend Gordon, but he chickened out. So we're going to shame him for that, and then we will have him in another episode. So let's get the heck right into it. All right, so the first case that we're going to briefly touch on is the case of the disappearance of the Springfield 3. So, let's hop right into that. Sorry, I had a brain break. Okay, so graduating high school is usually, an exciting time for most people. You get to have a celebration surrounded by all about you, your achievements, and sometimes you get gifts and money, which, is pretty nice. I'm graduating with a master's in December, and I hope that people pay for my next house. Anyways, yeah, you get gifts, you get money, but most of all, graduating high school, it symbolizes the opening of a new chapter in your life, a new start. You're considered an adult now. However, for two Springfield, Missouri teenagers and the mother of one of the teenagers, high school graduation brought on a tragedy. So two high school best friends named Suzanne Streeter, but we're going to call her Susie, and Stacy McCall are going to be, you know, the main two people that we talk about in this case, along with Susie's mother, Cheryl. So, Suzanne Streeter, Stacy McCall, and Cheryl, who is Susie's mother. A lot of S names, I know. Stick with it, okay? We'll get there. So, after graduating high school, Susie and Stacy, they didn't get to party with their friends or enjoy the beginning of summer in their new adult life because of what happened to them. They didn't get to go to any of the festivities that their friends were partaking in because shortly after graduation day, Susie, Stacy, and Cheryl disappeared. Still to this day, you know, 31 years later, this case remains unsolved and they have yet to be located, which is kind of terrifying. The craziest part to me is that logically they could still be alive and walking around because this didn't happen that long ago. You know, that it's plausible if they left on their own will that they're still alive. Sorry, I just had to pull my dog out of the blinds. That's crazy, Clover. Okay, so flashback. All right, it's 1992. Susie's 19 and Stacy's 18. They just graduated from Kickapoo High School on June 6th. I love that name, Kickapoo. Their day is filled with popping in and out of all their friends' graduation parties and celebrating their own accomplishments. The last known confirmed sighting of the two girls is at 2:15 a.m. on June 7th. They were seen leaving for home from their final party of the night. So someone saw them leaving a party and going home. They set off on their destination to Susie's house, where Stacy had intended on staying the night. So Susie and Cheryl's house is where Stacy was planning on staying. All three of the ladies were presumed to be there, okay? Clover, ma'am, quiet down, please. Please. You know, supporting audience is supposed to be quiet until they're called upon. Thanks. Okay, so now we're going to pause on that topic and talk about Cheryl for a little bit. So Cheryl was 47 at the time of this case. Ma'am, I'm going to need you to leave. Okay, you're disrupting my show. Okay, yes. So Cheryl was 47 at the time of this case. She was a cosmetologist and rumored to be a great mother. The last known account of Cheryl was at 11:15 on June 6th when she called a friend to discuss painting an armoire that she owned. So that's the last time that Cheryl was known to be, you know, okay. So Susie and Stacy's belongings were found at the house, which means that we at least know that they made it to the house. Their purses, clothes, cigarettes, and makeup were found in Susie's room, so we can assume that they were at least there before they disappeared. In addition, Clover, it's really a lot. It's a lot, and you're not even a part of this show. You're being a diva. Thank you. Okay. So, in addition, their cars were parked in the driveway. Now, it's very plausible that someone could have dumped their belongings in the room and somehow gotten their cars in the driveway, but for now, we will just assume that they are the ones that drove to the house, and they were the ones that went in the room and put their makeup and their cigarettes and whatever else. That was them. In our brains, that was them. The next morning, some friends showed up to Susie's house because they all had plans to go on a trip the next day. However, to their surprise, you know, Susie, Stacy, and Cheryl were nowhere to be found. These friends that showed up to the residence were doing so because they all had planned to go to a water park in Branson, Missouri. The friends' names were Janelle Kirby and her boyfriend. So Janelle Kirby, a friend of the girls, was expecting Susie and Stacy to meet her at her house the morning of June 7th to head to Branson. However, when the girls didn't show up, she and her boyfriend decided to go over to Susie's house to, you know, see what was going on, see why they weren't coming over. You know, nowadays we just send a text, but back then they did not have the facilities to do so. So, something odd that I found while researching this case was that when Janelle and her boyfriend went over to Susie's house, the porch light, like the light that was over the porch, was broken and there was glass all over the ground. So the boyfriend thought he was being nice and he like picked up all the glass and dumped it in the trash can in the garage, but that actually damaged critical evidence because there are minimal clues in this case And, you know, that was possibly a lead that now is not, because it's cleaned up. So moral of the story, don't be a jerk and leave messes where they are, okay? Be nice by leaving messes. So when Janelle went over to the house, she peeked into the windows and everything looked normal. Three cars were in the driveway. Nothing apart from the busted porch light looked out of place. You know, everything just looked normal. And back in the 90s, nobody locked their doors. Even people don't now. But the house was unlocked, so Janelle and her boyfriend just, you know, went right in. Please, for the love of God and all things you find holy, if your friends ever randomly ghost you and you can't get a hold of them, and you go over to their house and no one's answering the door, but their cars are in the driveway, and then you see broken glass on the front porch, do not go in. I research crime rates for part of my job, and I swear that the massive decrease in high-profile cases like this is unexplainable, but, you know, I really think that it's because people back then were so stupid and we have knowledge now. Like, don't walk right into a crime scene, knowing or unknowing, just don't do it. Okay, anyways, Janelle walks in, Susie's dog Cinnamon is barking like crazy, but unharmed, so, you know, no one's there, nothing looks out of place. She leaves and calls Janice, who is Stacy's mom. Stacy's mom is gonna come. Okay, so Stacy's mom had no idea where the girls were either, but she also wasn't alarmed because she knew that Stacy had so many plans going on that weekend. And as many of these old cases go, 911 was not immediately called. If y'all think something sus, call 911, okay? If something seems out of place, report it. Please. Okay, so Janelle and her boyfriend were getting ready to leave, and they noticed that Susie and Cheryl had not taken their purses with them, but more importantly, their cigarettes. Apparently, they never went anywhere without their cigarettes. So it was a telltale sign that, you know, something was up. Just as they were about to exit the home phone actually rang, and Janelle answered it. The caller on the other end didn't identify himself, and neither Janelle nor her boyfriend recognized his voice. However, the caller did start to make gross, sexually explicit comments, so Janelle just quickly hung up the phone, thinking it was some immature prank call from a friend or classmate. Because, you know, they did that back then, I guess. Later on in the day, with no sign of her daughter, Janice, Stacy's mom, arrived at the house, and to her surprise, the house was still empty and the front door was still unlocked, so she also just went right on in. When she entered the home, she saw exactly what Janelle and her boyfriend had seen, but upon closer inspection, she did find her daughter's bathing suit, car keys, makeup, and a change of clothes that were neatly stacked in a pile at the end of Susie's bed. And then she also found evidence of the girls removing their makeup before bed. So that allows us to assume that they were at least there throughout the night, or they made it that far into their night. They were able to, you know, get ready for bed, take their makeup off. Roughly 16 hours after the women were last seen, the police were finally called, and once again, in 90s fashion, as word spread about the missing women, people flocked to the house, which further contaminated the crime scene before the police could even, you know, get there to sweep it. The first and most prominent at the time suspect was Bart Streeter. This was Susie's brother and Cheryl's son. Apparently, he had just gotten into a pretty serious fight with his mom and sister about his drinking problem. He was able to provide the authorities with a tight alibi that was effectively ruled out as a suspect. But in addition to Bart, authorities suspected Susie's ex-boyfriend, Dustin Rekla. Dustin and his friend Michael Clay were already under police watch pretty frequently because they had a recent vandalism charge. However, the vandalism charge was them breaking into a cemetery, digging up graves, and removing gold teeth from the corpse. I don't think that's vandalism. I think that's disgusting. But in the end, Dustin and Michael cooperated with police and were also ruled out as suspects. Authorities kept looking into people, sweeping the house for clues and grid searching the area, and then eventually, months later, the case went cold and was pushed to the back burner with the rest of the unsolved. 4 years later, in 1996, a tip came in that actually led authorities to a Texas inmate named Robert Craig Cox. We do not like people with two or three first names. You know, the people like Steven Stevenson, you have two first names, okay? Bad guy, immediately. So, Cox was an Army Ranger who was arrested and convicted in 1988 for the murder of Sharon Zellers, 10 years before this. However, the decision was reversed by the Florida Supreme Court in 1989 due to insufficient evidence. And other crimes under Robert's belt kept him incarcerated, including the 1986 kidnapping and assault with a deadly weapon in California, which he, you know, pled guilty to. Good guy. Good track record. Good guy. So, Richard was paroled in 1990 and returned back to his hometown, Springfield, Missouri. Like BTK, he worked a job that allowed him to go into people's homes. He was working this utility-type position at the time of the disappearance of the Springfield 3. In addition, he also worked as a mechanic at a used car lot where Stacy's father was employed as a car salesman. So the plot thickens. There's history here. He actually was interviewed as a suspect back in 1992, but he had an alibi that was corroborated by his girlfriend. Convenient, huh? Later on in the 90s, Cox was imprisoned once again, but this time he was serving a 30-year sentence for an armed robbery in Texas. Man's just cannot act right. He can't get it right. Now we're here in 1996, where he told a KY3 news reporter that he knew something about the disappearance and the deaths of the Springfield 3. No one has ever said anything about death yet. That was all him. He brought that up. So he told the reporter that he knew the women were dead and that their bodies were somewhere that they would never be found. Oh, did y'all hear about the updates on the JonBenet Ramsey case? What do y'all think about that? Let me know. In addition, Cox's girlfriend that provided him with the tight alibi back in 1992 went on to actually recant her statement. Yeah. She told authorities that Cox made her lie to the cops about his whereabouts that day. Unfortunately, like many offenders, Cox was known for attention-seeking and admitting to crimes that he actually never committed. And because authorities had no concrete evidence other than Cox's word, they didn't pursue a search, and the case once again fell cold. Just cold, you know? And now we're here in 2023 with no answers. Theories, as with any case, run rampant all the way from skilled kidnappers to human traffickers to calculated murderers. I will let you know, a lot of people are scared of trafficking, but it's not as common as you think it is, and also it will usually happen with, like, you'll usually be trafficked by the people that you know and trust the most, so don't be scared of just being kidnapped by random people. I mean, be alert. That's a good thing, to be alert, but don't be scared of being trafficked. Just be smart. So, investigators even received an anonymous tip that the three were buried in the foundation of a parking lot of a local hospital, but they never tore up the concrete in suspicion that it was fake. Now, it's a hospital. They probably have money to rebuild, right? So, if you have no other leads, why are you not doing everything you can? Like, I'm sure the hospital can rebuild, right? Okay. Anyways, in 2019, Bart Streeter, Susie's brother, Cheryl's son, was arrested on the suspicion of public intoxication, disorderly conduct, and attempted false imprisonment of a 15-year-old in Tennessee. So clearly, he still has a drinking problem. And then in 1997, the women were declared legally dead, but they could very well still be out there. So what do y'all think about that? Also, the Springfield police are still taking tips on this case. If you have any information, or if you think that you have any information, you can submit a tip on their department website under the 3 missing women tab. Obviously, with cases that are cold, especially the ones that were back in the 90s before we had the technology that we do now, it's really important to report everything you see, or know. So someone that you know could even know something about it. So yeah, if you have a tip, they have a page on their department website specifically for this case. I'm going to take a break and breathe, and then we'll get on to the next case. Okay, I am very excited to talk about this next case. It's one of my personal favorites, and I hate saying that, but you guys know what I mean. It is the Dyatlov Pass incident. I think I'm saying that word right. I've heard many people say it, and I've heard a few different variations, but I think the Dyatlov Pass is the correct pronunciation. Okay, so in the winter of 1959, 9 graduate students, 2 women, and 7 men set off on a monumental ski/hike in the Ural Mountains. What happened to them is still a mystery to this day. So I'm going to be saying names throughout this telling of this case, and the names are difficult. I'll say that. I have a difficult name. My full name is Laurel. People mispronounce it all the time. However, I will do my best, but if I mispronounce them, I'm sorry. So, Igor Dyatlov was... he's the namesake for the case. He was an extremely skilled hiker, and he organized this trip to explore the Otorten Mountain slopes in the northern part of the Ural Range. So yeah, that obviously the names are a little weird. Not weird, I shouldn't say weird, that's rude. They're just different, and I am not educated enough to pronounce them correctly. They're Russian, I believe. So, the initial plan was to send 10 very skilled hikers out into the wilderness on January 27th, 1959. However, Yuri Yudin left the day before they set out onto the trip because of an illness. So, also, side note, before we even get into anything, the hikers were very, very skilled. They had trained for this hike for months because, you know, they knew how intense it was going to be. Like, these people knew what they were getting themselves into. They were prepared for chaos. And Igor, the leader, was very educated on hiking and these mountains. So anyways, the team of 9 decided to go on without Yuri, and he did wish them the best and told them that it was okay if they went on without him. He was the one that was sick. So they set off on the hike that would later become known as the Dyatlov Pass incident. Just a few days into their trip, a giant winter storm set in, decreasing the visibility and blocking the roads for people in town. So who knows how bad it was up in the mountains. We do know that on February 2nd, 1959, they set up camp on the eastern slope of a mountain called Kolot Cycle. That's so not how it's said. It's K-H-O-L-A-T-S-Y-A-K-H-L. Clover, ma'am, no squeakers, please. Unfortunately, that same night, all 9 members passed away under very strange circumstances. Those on the Dyatlov hike informed their friends and family back home that they would be back around February 12th, maybe earlier, maybe later. So it didn't startle anyone when February 12th came and went with no sign of the group. However, a few days after the 12th, with no messages from the group, a rescue crew was sent on the path. This dog never, ever picks up her chew toys with squeakers in them and just squeaks them. She usually goes for the hard bones or the Kong toys, like the rubber toys. The second I sit down to record a podcast, what is she doing? She grabbed a damn squeaker toy. Okay, so, where are we? The rescue crew, why can't I say that word? Rescue crew was sent on the path. And then on February 26th, the search team stumbled upon the group's campsite and discovered the terrible scene. A member of the group's tent was found sliced open from the inside out. Other tents were abandoned with the belongings still inside, indicating that people in them left in quite a rush, you know, like a hurry. Additionally, the search party was able to find the footprints of roughly 8 to 9 people, all heading in the direction of the tree line. Oddly enough, though, they were all barefoot. So the footprints were all of socked feet, or completely barefoot feet. Their shoes were found at the campsite. It's cold. Why would they have no shoes on? It's freezing. And they're skilled hikers, you know? They are aware. So following the footprints only led investigators to an even more puzzling discovery. Right at the edge of the forest, the bodies of 2 students were found, shoeless, only wearing their undergarments. These 2 students were Yuri... Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Yuri Krivnichenko. Krivnichenko. And Yuri Doronchenko. At the time of their death, it was around negative 22 degrees. Because of the conditions on the mountain, finding the rest of the group was pretty difficult. However, within 3 weeks, the search team found more of the bodies. Some of these bodies were found up to a mile away from the campsite, even. It seems that those who had survived whatever killed the first 2 had tried to make their way back to the campsite at some point because their bodies were found huddled around a burnt-out fire. And then another two months went by before the remaining hikers were found. Those who were left were found partially clothed, and there was something weird about their clothing. After being tested, it came back that their clothing had high levels of radiation. So, what are you thinking right now? What is your brain going to right now? What's the answer? The last of the bodies that were found seemed to have died, you know, the most traumatic deaths. They were found down in a ravine, 17 feet deep, actually, that they had dug by hand to seemingly take shelter from the cold. So here come some more names that I'm going to absolutely butcher. Nicholas Thibault Brignell was found with a fractured skull. His skull wasn't only fractured, it looked like it had actually been beat in. And then Alexander Zolotaryov had severe chest trauma, including crushed ribs. And then Lumila Dubinina also had broken ribs, but she had an injury that none of the other campers had. Her tongue was completely gone. So it's obvious that some of these injuries could have been from falling into the ravine, but how did her tongue go missing? Her tongue. In the end, Russian officials declared that the cause of death was an unknown but compelling force, which the hikers were not able to overcome. Obviously, with a vague conclusion like that, people started to speculate. So why would the hikers run into the cold with no shoes and little clothing? Why was Lumila's tongue seemingly ripped out of her mouth? I don't know, but there are theories. So the theories range from UFOs to avalanches to undisclosed nuclear testings in the area, which actually isn't far-fetched in this area of the world, but we'll get into the theories. So the avalanche theory goes as such. The dangers of avalanches are actually pretty common in that region. A portion of the upper layer of snow could have shifted and rolled over the tourists. This would explain the disaster, the cutout tent, and some of the physical trauma that the campers experienced. An avalanche would damage the tent and wreak havoc against the group, but the tent being cut open could be explained by them deciding to cut it open in order to escape the snow and avoid being trapped in. It would also reveal the reason for the group leaving all of their belongings behind, including the shoes. However, the theory has its gaps. The Diet Love Party included many, many experienced and skilled skiers/hikers, who would have known how to react in a situation like this. Also, the tent did not demonstrate any signs of damage from an avalanche. A middle portion of the tent did collapse, but it is likely that that was due to the weight of the snow that had collected there over time while the campsite just sat. Also, does not explain for Lumila's tongue. That's the thing that I'm most hung up about. Like, all the other injuries, yeah. Weird, scary, random. The tongue, dude, the tongue. Okay? So, the next theory is military testing. Considering the secrecy, radioactivity, and the appearance of some of the bodies, they were described as deeply tanned. What deeply tans you? Have y'all seen Oppenheimer? Go see Oppenheimer. It's good. There was speculation that the campsite fell within a path of a Soviet parachute mine. The theory claims that the hikers panicked when they heard loud explosions. This led them to flee quickly out of fear. They could have left their belongings behind. They could have cut themselves out of the tent instead of unzipping it. When they attempted to return to their site, they realized that they were lost. There are records of parachute mines being tested around the location at the time of the group's expedition. That would explain some of the unnatural manipulation of some of the bodies and the orange skin and gray hair of others. However, radioactive dispersal would have affected all of the hikers, not just some. And then there's also a theory of paradoxical undressing. So 20 to 50% of hypothermia deaths are associated with paradoxical undressing. This occurs during moderate and severe hypothermia, where a person becomes disoriented, confused, and combative. In the victim's delirium, they may suffer from a hot flash causing them to undress. This symptom sadly only leads to a quicker death. It's plausible that this happened for some of the group's death, as hypothermia could be the leading cause. And it was confirmed that 6 of the 9 hikers did die from hypothermia. However, the last 4 found had acquired clothing from those who had already died. So if they had enough layers on, what caused their death, you know? And this doesn't explain the injuries. It just explains the death, not the injuries. Also, with those that had others' clothes on, did they find them dead and then take their clothes to survive? You know, there's so many questions. So, logicians? Why do I type words and I'm not sure how they're pronounced? Okay, anyways, they have explained away the fractured limbs and internal injuries by pinpointing that bodies that were found at the bottom of a rather steep cliff, they could have fallen down, you know, and gotten those injuries from that. But for the lost tongue, scientists and investigators have said that it's likely the result of just pure, you know, decomposition due to the melting snow. Although some reports still maintain that it was ripped from the mouth. So either it just plain decomposed or something ripped it out. Or someone. I don't know. Could have been of an animal, maybe? I don't know. This case leaves so many questions. And I don't know what I believe. Do you know what you believe? If you do, let me know. All right, now for the last case of the episode, we are going to talk about the Sauter Family Five. This case takes place in a little town called Fayetteville, West Virginia. The most exciting thing around these parts of West Virginia is the Mystery Hole. Yeah, you heard that right. You might have heard about this from TikTok, but I pulled this straight from the very outdated tourist attractions website. Go look it up. It's quite funny. So This is straight from the website. The Believe It or Not astounding experience has intrigued many people, both young and old, over the years. Many come time and time again, just curious to know if they really did see what they thought they'd seen, or if their eyes were playing tricks on them. Yet some have gone away so bewildered that they've headed in the wrong direction and became lost. Very often, keys get locked in the cars because occupants are too anxious to see the mystery hole and experience the laws of gravity in action. The mystery hole thing seems to affect different people in different ways, depending on whether they cling to the new style of education or stray to the plain old common sense method. Okay. We have noticed that the highly educated folks ask more questions than the lesser educated ones do. Whatever these unidentified effects may be, they are believed to not be in serious threat to those searching for fun and excitement. Weird offbeat attractions are not always easy to find in the wild, wonderful West Virginia. That's what makes the mystery hole a welcome change. Many people have passed this astounding, mystifying spot without realizing just how near they were to a whole hole full of interesting, intriguing, and incredible. Oh, they have a grammatical error. That's the end of that sentence. Okay, so there you go. That's West Virginia for you. Okay, so basically coming into Fayetteville, you have to cross the new River Gorge Bridge, which is 3,000 foot, it's a 3,000 foot steel arch that goes over the new river. Personally, no, I could not, but you do you. I hate bridges so much. So when people drive over that bridge, they are met with a billboard pleading for information about the 5 lost Sauter children. The official close to the case is that the 5 children, Maurice, Martha, Louis, or Louis, Jenny, and Betty, ranging from 5 to 14 years old, all died in a fire that broke out in the Sauter home on Christmas Eve in 1945. The parents, George and Jenny, believed that the children were kidnapped as some sort of a sick revenge. So a little bit about the parents. George and Jenny Sauter were both Italian immigrants. They both came to the States in their early teen years and went on to live out the perfect American dream lifestyle. George began his American life working on railroads in Pennsylvania to owning his own trucking company in West Virginia. He and his wife had 10 children and lived in a 2-story home on the outskirts of Fayetteville, where many Italian immigrants had settled. George was known to be a very hard worker, a dedicated family man, and very, very opinionated. He was frequently heard sharing his disapproval of the fascist dictator Benito Mussolini, who was seen by pre-World War II Italian Americans as a model of strength who had made Italy great again. Nothing good ever comes from a sentence where someone is described as making something great again, if you know what I'm saying. George would frequently get into arguments with other Italian Americans and was no stranger to receiving verbal threats from people that he didn't agree with. So, that's the backstory on George. On Christmas Eve in 1945, the Sauter family was getting ready to celebrate the holiday with 9 of their 10 children. Marion, who was 19, was the oldest daughter. She had recently begun working at a dime store, so she surprised 3 of her younger sisters, Martha, who was 12, Jenny, who was 8, and Betty, who was 5, with gifts. The 3 girls were so excited about their new toys that they begged their parents to stay up past their normal bedtime. And as 10 p.m. rolled around, As 10 p.m. rolled around, Jenny, I know it's confusing that there's Jenny a kid and Jenny a mom, but we're talking about the mom here. The mom, Jenny, told them that they could stay up later as long as the 2 boys, Maurice, who was 14, and Louis, who was 9, remembered to bring the cows in and feed the chickens before they went to bed. I miss growing up in the country, y'all. So George and the 2 oldest boys, John, who was 22, and George Jr., who was 16, they had spent the day working with their father, and they were already in bed. You know, you work hard and you sleep hard, right? So at 12:30 a.m., or sorry, I skipped over a little bit. After reminding the boys of their chores, Jenny took Sylvia, who was two, upstairs with her, and they went to bed. However, at 12:30 a.m., she was woken to a phone call. You know, the phone was ringing. And she went downstairs to answer it. When she answered, the caller was a woman who Jenny claimed she did not recognize the voice of. And the caller asked for a woman that Jenny did not know. So, you know, why are you calling this house at 12:30 a.m., waking me and my babies up? So after Jenny told the woman that she had the wrong number, the woman laughed, and Jenny could hear glasses clinking in the background. So she hung up and went back to bed. Initially, the phone call seemed like an innocent drunk dial, but after knowing the sinister things that took place later that night, Jenny wonders if it could have been a sign. As she turned to go back up the stairs, she noticed that the lights were still on and the curtains were not drawn. Two things that they always do when they go to bed. Marion had fallen asleep on the couch, so Jenny assumed that the other children who had stayed up later had gone upstairs to sleep. So she went ahead and closed the curtains and shut off all the lights and went to bed. And then at 1 a.m., just 30 minutes, 1 a.m., did I say that right? Just 30 minutes after the phone call, Jenny woke up to the sound of something hitting the top of the house and then rolling down the roof. She listened for a moment, heard nothing else, and went back to sleep. But after a while, she woke up again. This time, she smelled smoke. And when she walked around the house to locate the smell, she found that the room George used as an office was on fire, and the telephone was conveniently located in that room. Jenny ran to wake him up, as well as the two older boys, and both parents of and four of the children, Marion, Sylvia, John, and George Jr., had escaped the fire. They frantically yelled for the children upstairs but heard no response, and they were unable to access the stairs because they had already caught on fire. Because the phone was located in the one room where the fire broke out, getting help wasn't easy. Marion ran to the neighbor's house to call the fire department, as well as a passerby who saw the flames while driving. Unfortunately, neither of them were able to contact the operator, but eventually a neighbor was and had help sent to the house. So think about the damage that would have been, like, think about what the damage would have been had they been able to contact the fire department in a timely manner. Think about how little or just less damage there would have been. George attempted to climb the outside wall of the house. He broke open a window and cut his arm pretty badly in the process, and he was unsuccessful in entering the home. Again, he and his sons attempted to enter the house via a ladder that they had stored next to the house, but it was missing. And reports show that it was later found 75 feet away, thrown into a dried-up river. So George thought to use his work truck to gain height and climb into the house, but neither of them... He had two at the house, and neither of them would work despite having worked perfectly the day before while he was at work. So sadly, the six Sauter family members who had escaped the fire had to stand there and watch the house burn to the ground for the next 45 minutes. In their minds, the other five children had all died in the flames. And due to the war and lack of phone service in Fayetteville, the fire department didn't arrive until later that morning. The firefighters, one who was a brother of Jenny's, could do little now that the house was gone, but they looked through the ashes that were left in the basement of the family home. By 10 a.m., the chief told the parents that they could not find the children's bones or any sign that people had even died in the fire. However, during later questioning, Chief Morse would claim that he found, or that he thought the fire was just hot enough that it destroyed the evidence of any human remains. Chief Morse, I got some opinions about him. We'll get into that, though. After 4 days and no answers, the family couldn't stand the sight anymore, and George went ahead and bulldozed 5 feet of dirt over the ashes with the intention of turning it into a memorial garden for the lost children. Back then, they were not as forensically developed as we are now, and that scene hopefully would have been preserved just a little bit better. But, you know, people grieve, and that's all right. So investigators ultimately ruled that the fire was the result of faulty wiring, even though George just had an electrician rewire the house, and the Christmas lights remained on while the fire burned. So, a telephone repairman informed the Sauters that the house's phone lines had not just been burned through the fire,
but they had been cut. Someone was willing to climb 14 feet up the telephone pole and then reach 2 feet away to cut the phone lines on the house. Determination. Okay. So a local thief admitted to cutting the line and claimed that he had done it thinking that it was a power line, not a phone line. And then he said that it had nothing to do with the fire. I don't know, y'all. Jenny also had a hard time believing that the children were completely burned in the fire. Many of the household appliances were found and still completely recognizable, including pieces of the tin roof. Jenny even did research of her own by burning small piles of animal bones to see if they would burn to ash, and they never did. So after chatting with the local crematorium employee, Jenny concluded that there was no possible way that the fire was hot enough to incinerate the children's bones. Excuse me. Talking makes me burp. Then the family hired a private investigator, and the PI ended up finding something. So first, the PI found that an insurance salesman, one that had previously argued with George because of his anti-Mussolini statements, was on the coroner's jury that declared that the fire was an accident. Little sus, but also it's a small town. You know, the jury selection is small. The PI also discovered that the fire chief had found a heart among the ashes of the house. He secretly packaged the heart into a box and buried it on his own. This was confessed to a minister during a confession, and the minister confirmed it. And when confronted about the allegations, the fire chief admitted that he did find a heart and buried it without telling the family. Hmm? What? It gets better. So Chief Moore showed the family where the remains were buried. They dug it up, took it to a funeral director, and found out that it was actually just a fresh beef liver that had never been exposed to the heat since it was frozen. Later, it was rumored that the chief knew that the liver wasn't a heart, but he didn't, and that he didn't even find it at the scene, but he wanted the family to have closure, that the children's did die in the fire, so he staged it. I don't know. So the new year came, and spring approached, and Jenny tended to the flowers and the soil over the memorial site, though many people, including the family, think that they were memorializing people that could still very well be alive. Evidence emerged that the fire had not started due to electricity faults, but it was actually set on purpose. A bus driver who routinely passed the Sauter home claimed to see people throwing balls of fire at the house. And then a few months later, when the snow melted and exposed the frozen ground underneath, green, hard rubber balls were found, and the family claimed to know nothing about them. George also recalled Jenny hearing a loud thump and roll on the roof before the fire started, thinking that a hand grenade or some other combat device could have been used to start the fire. The family also insists that the fire started on the roof, despite the Marshall's, you know, disagreement, saying that it started somewhere else. Other accounts claim to have seen the Sauter children themselves. They say that they saw them in the flesh. One woman who had been watching the fire from the road said that she saw someone passing by and watching the house as it burned. Which, okay, first of all, I would also be watching. Like, I'm nosy. I would also be, you know, I'd be watching. Another woman said that she saw the children at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston, claiming that she served them breakfast the morning after the fire, and a person with Florida license plates was accompanying them. In August of 1949, George was able to get Oscar Hunter, a Washington, D.C. pathologist, to conduct a search through the dirt of the house. A dictionary belonging to the children and some coins were found, as well as several small bone fragments determined to have been human vertebrae. The fragments were sent to the Smithsonian Institution to be tested and were confirmed to be human lumbar vertebrae. I think those are the lower ones. It's been several years since I took A&P, but I think those are the lower ones. Anyways, the bones were concluded to all be from the same person, aged around 16 or 17 years old. Unfortunately, that did not match any of the ages of the children who allegedly died in the fire. In addition, the bones had not been exposed to the flame. So whose bones were they? I legit don't know. I can't find that anywhere. So if you know, please let me know. While officials ended their efforts to close the case, the Sauter family never lost hope. They constantly put up flyers and pictures of the children, offering a $5,000 reward that grew as the years passed by. And in 1952, they put up the infamous billboard pleading for information from the public. After the billboards were put up, new tips began rolling in. One included... what? That was not English. Including one from Ida Crutchfield, who ran a hotel and claimed to have seen the children a week after the fire. The children had come in around midnight with two men and two women, all who were of Italian descent. When she attempted to speak to the children, one of the men snapped at the children in Italian and immediately the whole party stopped talking to the woman, except for that man that snapped. She recalled that they left the hotel very early the next morning. However, investigators do not consider her story credible. So there's that. George continued to follow many leads in person, traveling all over from where the leads had come. He went to St. Louis, Missouri, because a woman claimed Martha was being held there. He went to Texas because someone had heard two people talking about the fire in an incriminating way. Nothing ever came of the leads he pursued, and he knew he was running out of time. He went as far as making Jenny's family members prove that their own children were theirs and not stolen from him. In 1967, George went to the Houston area to investigate another tip where a woman had written to the family that Lewis had revealed his true identity to her one night after having too much to drink. This woman believed that Lewis and Maurice were both living in Texas somewhere. Police came and involved... What? Police became involved with this tip because of how promising it seemed, actually. But ultimately, the two men were found to not be the missing sons. Another letter that George received that year seemed to be the most credible evidence that they had seen yet. One day, he received a letter in the mail addressed to Jenny, postmarked in Central City, Kentucky. Inside this letter was a picture of a man around 30 who very strongly resembled Lewis. Conveniently, Lewis would have been around 30 at the time. The letter read, "Lewis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, I lil boys, A90132 or 35. Confused, obviously, the family hired another PI to go to Central City, Kentucky and look into the letter, but he never reported back to the Sauters, and they were not ever able to locate him again. The picture gave them hope, though, if nothing else. They ended up adding the photo of Lewis to the billboard and put an enlargement of it over their fireplace, which is really sad when you think about it. Sadly, George died in 1969. Never knowing what happened to his children. Jenny and her children, her surviving children, never stopped seeking answers for their family members. And after George's death, Jenny stayed in the family home, put a nice fence around it, and added rooms. It's rumored that for the rest of her life, she wore black every single day to mourn her family and would tend to the garden. It's so sad. The surviving Sauter children who went on to have their own families continued to publicize the case and investigate leads for their parents. They, along with the older Fayetteville residents, think that the Sicilian mafia attacked the family home that night, and the five children were taken by someone who knew about the planned arson in an attempt to save them. They were possibly taken back to Italy after that, and the family believes that if they were taken and survived all of these years, that they just avoided contact in order to keep the remaining family in the States safe from harm. Sylvia, who was two at the time, died in 2021. She claims that the fire was one of her earliest memories, as she was one of the last children to leave the home. She recalls moments of her dad staying up late, talking about, you know, what might have happened. She died believing that her siblings survived that night. John, one of the older boys, initially said that he physically tried to wake the five siblings as they were escaping from the fire, but then he recanted that statement, saying that he only yelled up to them because they were upstairs. Some believe that he really did physically try to wake them, using that as their evidence that the children died in the home that night. And that's all we have on the Sauter case. I believe that fire could have incinerated them. House fires are weird. When my family home burned down in 2013 or 14, there were parts of the home that were, like, untouched, and then parts that were completely gone. So, you know, fire's weird. It chooses where it wants to go. I believe that it could have incinerated the bodies, and then some parts of the house were, like, untouched. But also, I believed that the fire was probably out of malice. I don't know. But that's all I have for you guys today. Thanks for being patient with me while I get back into this. I'm very excited. I missed this a lot. I did not miss the vocal fry and the talking burps that it gives me. And also, we'll have to work around having the new addition, Clover, as she likes to be the center of attention 24/7. So yeah, you guys are awesome. I love you very much. Stay safe, lock your doors, and don't talk to creepy men.